Today on the John Ankerberg Show, in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, the world has watched nation after nation in North Africa and the Middle East turn into Islamic states and embrace Sharia law. This has raised many serious questions, including, what is Sharia law? Is Sharia law a threat to people's free speech, their freedom of religion, and basic human rights? How are Muslims to treat Christians, Jews, and other minorities in Islamic countries? How are women to be treated? And what groups and organizations in America are trying to institute Sharia law here? To answer these questions, my guests today are two former Sunni Muslims who grew up in Columbus, Ohio, where their father built mosques. When they made their decision to leave Islam and convert to Christianity, their father disowned them. Dr. Emir Kanner went on to earn his Ph.D. in history from the University of Texas and is now the president of Truett McConnell College in Georgia. Dr. Ergun Kanner received his Doctor of Theology from the University of South Africa and is provost and vice president of academic affairs at Arlington Baptist College in Arlington, Texas. We invite you to join us for this special edition of the John Ankerberg Show. Welcome to our program. I've invited two former Muslims to talk to you today, fellas that have crossed into becoming Christians. They've invited Christ into their life, and there was a struggle, and their family disowned them. They went on to get their PhDs, and now one of them is the president of Truett McConnell College in Northeast Georgia. The other is the vice president of academic affairs at Arlington Baptist College in Arlington, Texas. They're best-selling authors on Islam and Christianity, and professors in their own right have taught here in this country as well as around the world. I want to start today with a topic that is controversial, and that is, who is Muhammad? Because you have one of the world's largest religions revolving around what this person said and revealed through his revelations that he said he got from Allah. And he is supposedly the perfect example that Muslims are to follow in the world. And if that is the case, then we need to know a little bit about who he is, how he lived, what he said. And this is not your personal opinion, but we're taking this from the historical sources. So who wants to start us off today in terms of when we look at the life of Muhammad, what are the main facts, historical facts that we need to know?
Well, the key verse is what you just quoted, that Muhammad is the perfect or the excellent exemplar from Surah 33:21. Muhammad, as you see him, is not only the one who was given the revelation through Gabriel of the Quran, but his life is the example is found in the Hadith. And of course, you also have Ibn Ishaq, the oldest biography, written in 773. And so you have these sources that are precious to Muslims today. And when you, at first glance, look at his biography, he is an incredibly sympathetic figure. Born in 570, he's twice over orphaned. His father dies before his birth, and then his mother dies, and then his grandfather dies, and then he's raised by his uncle. Finally, he meets the love of his life that is 15 years older than him. She is a successful businesswoman, and Khadija becomes the love of his life until she passes away. So Muhammad is this incredibly sympathetic character to Muslims, and he is to Muslims what Moses is to the Jewish people, and they would say what Jesus is to the Christian people.
Wouldn't you say, Ergun, that if he is the perfect example, then this has ramifications for a lot of people? Number one, for women. Number two, for society, how people are to live in society. Number three, for those who are not Muslims.
Yes. It absolutely does. Every religion has a founder. Lao Tzu does Taoism, and you know, Confucius with Confucianism. And the question that you ask, the fundamental question is, all right, so if this person discovered this religion or founded this religion, how important were they? And in Islam, the Shahada, the creed that you say, is not just about Allah, which is the Arabic word for God, not the word for the God of the Bible, but a God. It's that Allah is the God, the only God, and Muhammad is his final seal of the prophets. He's the final prophet. And so he is elevated to the status of the final stamp. There are other prophets in Islam that they speak of. Moses and Jesus, they consider them prophets, but Muhammad, he's the final one. He's the one we measure by.
Is it true then that the way he lived is the way everybody else is supposed to live?
I would believe so, yes. Matter of fact, the exemplar, the term from Surah 33, he is the measurement. And so when you have Muhammad in the Quran as the exemplar, but then a collection of his words and sayings and deeds and laws called the Hadith, Al-Bukhari's Hadith, say, is 9 volumes long, and it's a collection of the things he did, those would be, say, a collection of the ethic, the law, and the jurisprudence, whereas the Quran is sort of the theological basis. I mean, you have in the Hadith Muhammad saying he was spiritually married to Mary. You have him saying that...
The mother of Jesus Christ.
The mother of Jesus Christ. You have Muhammad saying, I don't know where I'm going to go when I die. Well, if the exemplar of the faith doesn't know, how much hope do I as 1.5 or 1.6 billion Muslims, what chance do I have?
Let's go back to how did... He's married to Khadija, and all of a sudden he goes to a cave and he starts to have revelations. Take us back to that point and move on.
And you can see this in Bukhari's Hadith, volume 1, number 1. That's the beginning. And he goes into this cave, he receives revelation, and the fascinating thing is he comes home uncertain of the revelation. And it is his wife Khadija that gives him certainty that the revelation comes from Allah and not from some other source, maybe a demonic source or whatever it may be. And then she says, go back and write. And that's what he does. He starts to get these revelations that are orally transmitted. Others will write them down. Finally, they'll be codified over time, really. Muslims will believe under the third leader of Islam after Muhammad's death in 632, really centuries later, because the Quran that is now there is a Quran of the 10th century.
Let me become a secularist for a moment and just ask the question, why should anyone believe that a fellow that's in a cave that starts getting revelation, we should actually believe that it is coming from Allah?
Mm. Well, you know, you have to take their word on it, don't you? You have to, so many people over the course of time have said, look, I was alone and I received a vision. But the consistency is, for instance, the consistency between Muhammad and, say, Joseph Smith, receive a revelation, all alone. Joseph Smith's in a garden. Muhammad's in a cave. Muhammad's on his 40th birthday. Joseph Smith is, you know, there he's in New York. Both of them, however, say all religion is dead. All true religion is wrong. But the revelation I'm receiving, this revelation is from God, both of them from an angel, right? Angel Moroni or the angel Jibreel. And this revelation says, I've been selected to fix it. They set themselves up as, I am the arbiter of truth. I am the justifier. I'm the canon. I'm the measurement. You have to measure what they say and how they lived. My comparison to any Muslim, whenever they say, well, you know, look at Moses or look at David, great. Moses and David are not the reason I'm a Christian. Oh, well, I don't like the Baptist or I don't like your pastor. Fine. I don't know. I don't like half the Christians I know. They're not the reason I'm a Christian. I follow Jesus. Compare Jesus to Muhammad. Now we can talk.
How did he live?
Well, just take his life. Here he is. He's married to Khadija, but then she finally dies. And now you start to see not only imperfections, but strong questions about his character. You see it. It's codified in the Quran, chapter 33, verse 37. All of a sudden, he has an adopted son, and he believes that he should marry his adopted son's wife. Even in the Arabian Peninsula, that's an incestuous relationship. He gets a revelation that says, yes, you should do so. So Allah tells him, your son should divorce Zainab, the woman, and you should marry her. Then all of a sudden, he gets a revelation saying he can have as many wives as possible. Chapter 33, verse 50. Of those wives, the most contentious, the most questionable of all the marriages comes with a young lady by the name of Aisha. This is found in Bukhari's Hadith, volume 7, number 64, where he is engaged to her when she is 6 years old and sexually consummates the marriage when she is 9. He is the perfect example, then means that in places like Niger today, you can hand over your daughter to be married even before puberty because he's the excellent example. And that's the picture. If you see that as an excellent example, you will follow him. If not, and you're a Muslim, you've got to reject Islam because you've got to reject the Prophet.
What else?
You not only measure what Muhammad said, but you measure what Muhammad did. the transitional point, if you will. He gets up and preaches in Mecca at first, and he says, here's what I've been taught. All these other gods are false gods. He doesn't get a lot of followers, and he's kicked out, and they have to flee to Medina. Muslims measure our calendar, Hijra, this moment when he goes to Medina. And at that moment, the message also changes. It's not just I have to be personally holy or good enough. It's now corporate. Jihad becomes the defining political characteristic, holy war.
Hold on to that. We're going to take a break, and we're going to talk about where did jihad come in and how did Muhammad practice it. And we also want to talk about the 1,000 years after Muhammad, how did his successors practice what he taught. So this next session is very important. Stick with us, folks. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. We're talking with two former Muslims that have come to know Christ, gone on to get their PhDs and their professors. And I'm talking about what they used to believe when they were in Islam about jihad. Where did it come in the life of Muhammad? Where did he come up with this, and how did he practice it, and what are the ramifications down through history?
The first series of sermons that he preaches, his basic message is very personal. It's Islam is the final religion. All of the other gods are idols. Here's Allah, accept him. And you can imagine, in a polytheistic society, that's not accepted. And so he's quickly almost run off. And it's with just a few converts, his wife, Abu Bakr, and some. So they end up in Medina, chased out. That is a pivotal point in the Islamic calendar, and it's a pivotal point in their lives, because when he gets to Medina, the message shifts to a more political, more corporate. Jihad becomes the political arm. Somebody's wronged you. If we have to go to a country, if you go to a place, this is our land, this is our God. And by the way, you fight in the name of Allah. It was, in fact, jihad as holy war. Holy war becomes the fabric upon which everything is written from then on.
The jihadic verse that begins this is Surah 22, verses 39 and 40, where if they've wronged you, you must go after them. You see it in the Hadith, volume 4, numbers 40 through about 317. The entire chapter, chapter 52, is called Jihad. If you go to war, chapter 3 and verse 195, and you die, you sit on soft couches. Chapter 9, which is a Medinan verse, after they go to Medina, and says, slay the enemies wherever you find them. And it's defined, the enemy is defined as those who do not believe in Allah or the last day. So all of a sudden, it's put into one microcosm. Fight unbelievers until there's a domination of the Islamic religion upon that land. And while you don't have to force conversion upon them, you do implement Sharia Islamic law upon them.
Question about the Quran. When you bring up this thing of, is it still prescribed today? People will go to the Quran and quote the beginning of the Quran where you have a peaceful Muhammad. And you have these other verses at the end of the Quran. Now, which one takes precedence?
Well, it's called abrogation in the short. They basically say the later ones override the earlier ones. But when Muhammad wrote those peaceful ones, they were in the minority. And they were saying, please, let us do our thing, you know. Once they become the majority, that goes out the window. There is no religious liberty. And so one of the examples, just in the same chapter, the second chapter of the Quran, you have Surah 2, where a Muslim will say, oh, but it says in Surah 2, oh, but you know, there's no prescription in Islam. There's no compulsion as the Islam. We, you know, we don't force. But earlier in the chapter, which is added later, it says you don't like to fight, but fighting is prescribed for you. You have to do it. It's what, when he was alive, Osama bin Laden quoted. He said, you may not like it, but you have to do it.
All right, so he brings this doctrine in, and he ties it to religious promises. What were some of the promises that were attached to this holy war?
Not only do you have them sitting on soft couches, chapter 3 and verse 195 and following of the Quran, but you have them drinking wine. As you know, wine and all alcohol are forbidden in Islam, and so heaven perfects that which you are forbidden here on earth. Same thing with the picture of women. Women, virginal women, according to Muslim, one of the compilers of a hadith, there will be more than 70 virginal women sexually serving men in heaven. So all these promises are made, and really the only guarantee is if you go to jihad, if you go to holy war, if you fight against the unbeliever, because chapter 4 of the Quran, they are open enemies to you.
Also, your sins are forgiven for sure, and you actually get to heaven for sure. Is that the only security that is promised in terms of eternal paradise for those that are in Islam?
They are the ones, the shaheed, the martyrs. They, and only they, know absolutely, beyond the shadow of a doubt, in Islam, where they are going. And we had spoken of the parallels between Mormonism and Islam. Here's a great one, because both of them have these women as sexual slaves, servants in paradise, because in Mormonism, the greatest hope a woman has is, what, to be the celestial bride, you know, pregnant for eternity. And in Islam, she is the servant. We've often asked, well, what do you do with the woman martyr? And that's an entirely different issue in Islam now. They're struggling with this because there are women who are dying. So are they at the 100th degree of paradise? Do they have couches and pomegranates? Are they being served?
Yeah, let's roll on. The fact is, so he starts this doctrine of jihad, and how does it play out?
Well, he dies in 632. Abu Bakr, one of his best friends and financiers of this entire movement, becomes a leader. And the greatest way to see what Muhammad was as the excellent example is to see what the first generation of believers did. Compare Jesus and his disciples to Muhammad and his disciples. All the disciples of Jesus, outside of the Apostle John, were martyred for the faith. All of the disciples of Muhammad went to war, all of them. And so all of a sudden, Muhammad dies in 632. They solidify the rest of the Arabian Peninsula under Abu Bakr. They, 2 years later, go to Damascus, Syria, then a majority Christian community, conquer that. 2 years after that, Baghdad. 2 years after that, Jerusalem, into Egypt, across North Africa, up through the Iberian Peninsula of Spain and Portugal, through the Pyrenees Mountains, into central France, where 100 years after Muhammad's death, finally they're stopped. Now, of all the pictures then, the question has to be asked, did the French attack them? Did the Spaniards attack them? North Africans, Assyrians? No, because Islam teaches an offensive war. That's what Muhammad did when he conquered Mecca, and that's what Muhammad demanded that Muslims do after he died.
So the fact is then, go down through history. How has that played out, and bring it to our own generation right now? Is it still part of Islam today?
Charles Martel, the grandfather of Charlemagne, is the guy who stops the onslaught of Islam at the Battle of Tours, 732. If Martel had not done so, Charles the Hammer, it would probably have taken over all of Europe. But from that moment, 732, it's not just a truce. It's basically set back, reload, and let's fight again. When the Crusades kick off, it's because the Muslims have taken Jerusalem, and they no longer allow the Catholics or the Orthodox to make pilgrimages. Catholicism and Orthodoxy had just split. The Pope sees an opportunity. I want to help rescue your people. And the Crusades are on. Doesn't make what the Christians did, the so-called Christians did in the Crusades. It didn't make what they did right. But finally, they decided they had to do something because Islam teaches paradise is in the shades of the sword. It's conversion, conquest, or death. And this was a land war. This was political. And Islam's eschatology to this moment is based on the world domination, the subjugation of the world under Islam. You see their signs, the slogan in London in 2001, Islam's world domination. Our goal, our mission, world domination.
Yeah, that was on their magazine that was published in London. Today, you have the Brotherhood already here in America, all right? And in, what was it, 2004, the FBI found some documents from the Brotherhood leaders talking about their plans for America. How does jihad enter into what they're saying?
Well, since now more than 80% of New Testament cities, those found in the New Testament, are now under Muslim rule, they want to sweep west. They want to both solidify their own governments to be Islamic under Sharia law, and then as a minority, try to get Sharia law in the court system in particular, as well in the United Nations and its judicial system in the West. Their nickname for Europe right now is Eurabia, because while Muslims are procreating at 3 to 4 babies on average, the Europeans are having 1, if they're lucky, 1.5. And they're seeing a full conquest of the West, something they couldn't do in 732, finally they can do in the 21st century.
In the time that we've got left, compare Jesus with Muhammad. Which one should we follow?
Now, I don't want it to seem like when we're comparing Muhammad to Jesus that we're, you know, comparing two men of noble lineage or two people with wonderful histories. This is I don't want it to come so low as to just be a history lesson. We are comparing the one whose claim is he was God before he left, came to earth to die to be the sacrifice, the God-man Jesus Christ. The law of non-contradiction in philosophy, something can't be and not be something at the same time. Jesus either was who he said he was or he's not. And you cannot embrace both Islam and Christianity. Christianity is not about men or movements. It's about Jesus Christ. And for us, our conversion was accepting Jesus, who said what he was going to be, said what he was, offered himself as a sacrifice, and died for us. Sharia law, the life of Muhammad, nothing even comes close to dealing with my heart, my forgiveness, my sin. Only Jesus Christ bridges that gap.
When you're looking at an example, you have to look at an example who is perfect. There are no mistakes in it. And you have to ask the question, is Muhammad the example you wish to follow? Is his life wanting to be your life? Or do you want to accept the perfection of Christ, the perfection of his sacrifice, the resurrection, the proof that he said who he said he is, the giver of life, the salvation of souls? And you have to answer that question not only factually, but personally.
Jesus Christ took the final act of cosmic violence on the cross. Jesus never killed in his name. Jesus Christ called us to die to ourselves, die to our selfishness. And the perfect picture, greater love hath no man than this. He laid down his life for us. In Islam, if you were to follow the Prophet Muhammad, you kill, you fight,